It's nice to be with all of you again this morning. The elders of the congregation here asked me to talk on a particular subject, and that subject can be described in one word, alcohol. The word alcohol is not found in the Bible, and I'll have more to say about that in a minute, but when late last year out in the lobby, one of the elders mentioned to me that they'd like to have me talk about this subject during 2010, I couldn't help but think of something that happened down in Mississippi many years ago, down in the strong prohibition corridor of the Bible Belt. The editor of a country newspaper had the gall to ask a politician during a campaign where he stood on the whiskey question. Now, that was a horrible thing to do to anybody in Mississippi back in those days who was running for office because they couldn't possibly win politically. If you said, I'm for whiskey, you'd lose half the votes and win the other half. If you said, I'm against whiskey, just the opposite would be true. And if there were more than two in the race, then you'd be in a bad way. And so this politician wrote back to the newspaper editor and he said, sir, I had not planned to discuss this controversial question at this time, but far be it from me to sidestep any issue. And that is true regardless of the nature of the question and regardless of the result of the answer. But I want to be sure that I understand you. If when you say whiskey, you mean that devil's brew, that poison scourge, that monster that defiles innocence, that dethrones reason and creates misery and poverty, that takes the bread out of the mouth of babies, if when you say whiskey, you mean that vile drink that topples Christian men and women from the pinnacle of righteous and gracious living into the bottomless pit of despair, destroys homes, creates orphans, deprives the community in general. Sir, if that's what you mean by whiskey, then I want you to put in your paper that I promised my constituents if I'm elected, I will fight to destroy this demon with all the strength I possess. But if by whiskey, on the other hand, you mean that oil of conversation, if you mean that philosophic wine and ale that's consumed when good fellows get together, that puts a song in their hearts, laughter on their lips, and is the medicinal spirit that puts the spring in an old man's step on a frosty morning, if you mean that nectar of the gods, the sale of which puts untold millions of taxes into our treasury, allowing us to care for orphan children, the blind and the deaf, and build great highways and schools and hospitals to make the world a better place to live. If that's what you mean by whiskey, then I want you to put in your paper that I promised my constituents, if I'm elected, that I will fight to protect this essence of divinity with all the strength I possess. And then he added the crowning touch, the capstone of it all, when he said, now that I have answered your query without equivocation, I hope you'll put in your paper, in good conscience, that I'm a man with the courage of my convictions, and that this is my stand, and I will not compromise. This is my stand. A lot of people seem to feel very strongly both ways about the subject of alcohol. Well, I'm not running for anything this morning, and I don't intend to send an uncertain sound on this subject. When I sit down at the end of the lesson this afternoon, because I do plan to talk about this morning and afternoon, and when I'm done, I want everybody who was here to clearly understand what I have said on the subject of alcohol, because there is no drug known in the world that's giving the world more trouble than ethyl alcohol. As I said, the word alcohol is not found in the Bible, and that contributes to a lot of confusion about it among believers in the Bible. When you and I read the word wine, we may have a tendency to think of a drink with alcoholic content. I don't know of any drink that's called wine in our time that does not have some alcohol in it. Maybe you do, but I don't think that I do personally. But the word wine, as we read it in the Bible, does not necessarily denote and should not necessarily connote that idea at all. Because the word wine is ambiguous. The word wine is a generic term. It applies either to non-alcoholic or to alcoholic wine. In other words, there's nothing in the word wine itself that tells us which it is. Wine, the word wine, was used by the ancient people to talk about grape juice in all of its forms, whether fermented or unfermented. There's nothing in the Bible that encourages the social drinking of alcohol. There's nothing in the Bible that encourages me to endorse the social drinking of alcohol. In fact, far to the contrary. Everything we have in the Bible and my own observations over many years force me to discourage you from the social drinking of alcohol. I don't see anything to be gained by it, and I see many grave dangers in it. Liquor has hung more crepe and shed more blood and snapped more wedding rings and twisted more limbs, blinded more eyes, sold more homes, armed more villains, cheapened more women, shamed more fathers, murdered more victims, robbed more houses, and sent more people before the throne of God unprepared than all the plagues on this earth since the days of Pharaoh. As a society, we make a product which is known to attack the powers of judgment. And then we complain that the people who use it don't exercise judgment. Alcohol is a depressant, and the very first thing to be depressed is the power of restraint. This is one reason it is drunk. People often drink alcohol to be able to say things that they would not otherwise have the guts to say, and to do things that they would not otherwise find the courage to do. That's why it's called sometimes liquid courage. The impairment of discrimination begins with the beginning of the drinking. Some impairment of judgment occurs with any drinking at all. And you may very well say to that, well, it sure doesn't feel that way. And that's part of the problem. No. Wine is a mocker, strong drink is raging, and whoso is deceived thereby is not wise. Deception occurs. It doesn't feel like it's done what it has done to you. This is one of the issues. I was talking to a young man one time who was drinking and driving, and I told him that his judgment was impaired, his reaction time was slowed, and he said, well, I just don't believe it. But the problem is, whether we believe it or not, that's the reality of it. You can be as delusional about it as you want to while you're under the influence, but it does slow your reaction time, and that begins immediately. The drinker is in the worst possible position to make the decision of whether it's safe for him to drive or not. And that's why we have the slogan developed recently that friends don't let friends drive drunk, because the drunk friend is not in a position to make that decision. Do you realize that alcohol is detectable in your brain within a half minute of being swallowed? And reaction times are slowed immediately when you take that first drink. Driving simulation machines have proven this for many, many years. It immediately destroys, to some degree, our powers of discrimination. And there are some researchers who say that physically, every time you take a drink, you die a little because of the damage done. Alcohol is an addictive drug. No heroin user needs his heroin more than an alcoholic needs his bottle. Alcohol often is used to self-medicate underlying emotional and spiritual issues, when really we'd be so much better off just facing and dealing with and solving those emotional and spiritual issues. Now, I have said that the word wine in the Bible is ambiguous. And I'd like to back that up. The Lord said through Isaiah that new wine is found in the cluster. In other words, in the cluster of grapes. The juice is called wine, tirosh is the Hebrew word, while it's still in the grape. Isaiah 65, verse 8. Now, obviously, there's no alcohol in a grape. But it's called, the juice in there is called wine, even while it's in the grape. Sometimes grapes were referred to as hanging wine. Aristotle spoke of sweet wine as wine in name, but not in effect, he said. Another ancient author spoke of trampling the grapes and the new wine running out clear across the road. He spoke of taking wine in from the fields. On the other hand, wine in 1 Samuel 1:14, where Eli was having a conversation with Hannah and was mistaken about her condition, in that case, wine refers to an intoxicating drink. So that we find the word wine used both ways. Alcoholic beverages are the result of fermentation. Fermentation is a process in which yeast cells act on the sugar content of fruit juice and convert that sugar into carbon dioxide and alcohol. Fermentation will continue until all the sugar has been acted on by the yeast cells, or until the fermenting mixture contains from 10 to 14% alcohol. And at that point, the concentration of alcohol is sufficient to cause the yeast cells to stop their functioning. As a matter of fact, natural fermentation cannot produce what modern people often drink for wine. A natural wine will have about 12% alcohol in it, because it stops fermenting at that point. But modern wines often contain from 20 to 24% alcohol because they have been fortified with extra alcohol put into them. When we look at the ancient literature on this subject, we find that the fresh grape juice was called must, and the yeast was a little fungus plant, and the grape juice, as I said, was fermented by that yeast. A gallon of grape juice produces 50 gallons of carbon dioxide. Let me say that again. A gallon of grape juice fermenting produces 50 gallons of carbon dioxide. It's really quite an elaborate process to make drinkable alcoholic wine. As a matter of fact, it's a more of a chore to make alcoholic wine than it is to preserve non-alcoholic grape juice. In other words, it's easier to keep grape juice from becoming alcoholic wine than it is to make it into drinkable alcoholic wine. The idea that the ancient people had no alternative to drinking alcoholic wine is just not true. They weren't as ignorant as we sometimes might tend to think. They knew a lot of things. They knew how to prevent fermentation, that's for sure. In fact, they had at least four ways that they could prevent fermentation. They did it by heat, they did it by cold, they did it by evaporation and thickening. They also did it by filtering. Pliny, in his Natural History, spoke of 91 different kinds of grapes and distinguished 50 different varieties of wine. He spoke of a certain wine that was still in the consistency of honey 2 centuries after it had been made. And he used the word wine over and over again to refer to unfermented grape juice. The ancient people did not have to drink intoxicating wine. They made it because they wanted it. Nature does not make drinkable intoxicating wine without human ingenuity giving her a helping hand. And I stress that because I have heard many times that alcoholic wine practically makes itself. But that's really not true. If you think it is, call a brewery and ask them if it's true and hear them tell you about all the effort that they have to put in to make it what it is. Watch their commercials on TV, or I don't know if they advertise it on TV or not, but watch their commercials, listen to their commercials, read them, and see them brag about the skill and the know-how that they have to make their product and why theirs is better than everybody else's. Yeast, for example, is extremely sensitive to heat and cold. Yeast does its best work between 65 and 80 degrees Fahrenheit. When I worked at Ralph Bratcher's donut shop years ago, we kept the yeast in a special little refrigerator down underneath the counter, and we didn't get it out until we were ready to use it. And then we would take out a couple of yeast cakes, and we would put them into a big pot, but we would put it in there with it, water that was heated to exactly the right temperature. So many times I've stood at that faucet with the thermometer in the canister of water to get exactly the right temperature for that water before I would put it in with the yeast so that the yeast could do what it was supposed to do. It had to be at a precise temperature in order to activate that. Boiling grape juice ensures that there is no fermentation. The preserving of grape juice was relatively simple. Boiled wine varied in thickness depending on how much water was evaporated out of it by the boiling process. Some of it could be drunk straight, but much of it was watered out of necessity. Sometimes even the sweet wines were watered by a ratio of 20 to 1. That's a lot of water mixed in with the wine. Boiling ensured that if there was any alcoholic content, it was removed. Some of you have undoubtedly cooked with alcoholic wine. When you cook with alcoholic wine, you know that alcohol evaporates during the cooking process. And that's true whether you're boiling something or not, because alcohol evaporates at only 173 degrees Fahrenheit, whereas water doesn't boil until 212 degrees. So there's a 39 degree difference between the two. The numerous ancient writers gave instructions to people so that they could have grape juice all year long. Unfermented grape juice was in daily use by the ancient peoples all year around. The 40th chapter of the book of Genesis and verse 11 proves that grape juice in its pure and unfermented form was not unknown and was used. The butler took grapes and he pressed the contents of them into Pharaoh's cup and he gave the cup into the hand of the Pharaoh. Simple process. And Josephus, when he's describing that, calls this freshly expressed grape juice wine. We could quote dozens of ancient and more recent authors showing that the word wine is applied to grape juice and to other fruit juices in various stages. Boiling grape juice for 4 or 5 hours reduces it to a fourth of the quantity that you started with, and then they would take that and just cool it and put it in earthen vessels, and excluding all the air, they would cause it to stay fresh for quite a long, indefinite period of time. So the word wine, when we see it in the Bible, settles nothing so far as the alcohol question is concerned. It doesn't settle whether it was an inebriating or non-inebriating state, in that kind of a state. There are 13 words in the Bible that are used for wine, and in our time today, I'm not going to go talk about all these words. It would be too tedious, and it would be hard for us to stay together on that, and it's not really necessary for us to do it in a study like this. I'll say this, grapes could be had at any time of year. They could be preserved. Josephus speaks of different kinds of fruits that were laid up in the Masada, for example, against a siege. He said that they were ripe and they were not at all inferior to fresh fruits, and they had been laid up there for, he says, get this, 100 years. They'd been laid up by Herod in the Masada for 100 years. William Whiston, in a footnote on that, when he translated Josephus, he said that this strange testimony accords with the word of Pliny, that Pliny also talked about these things being preserved for a long, long period of time. They would keep grapes in this way by hanging them in clusters from the ceiling of a well-closed room, and they would just stay. Grapes were used for lots of other things than making alcoholic wine. They were eaten fresh. They were made into raisins. There were at least 16 different uses for the grape in ancient times. They even pickled grapes, and this was considered a great delicacy. Grape juice drinks and semi-solids were as common among the ancients as tea and coffee are among us now. I say that because in a country like ours, where our vintage is gathered chiefly for the purpose of making intoxicating wine, it's difficult to do justice to the language of Scripture, which extols the vine and the products of the vine. In modern parlance, as I said, I don't know of anything personally that's now called wine that's not intoxicating. So we have to be clear on what the Bible is saying and what it is not saying. You know, words do change their meanings. So the word baptize in certain parts of the world today means basically sprinkle or pour, as it's used in common parlance. But it's very important to recognize the history of a word. Words often change their meaning. Sometimes they widen, sometimes they narrow. A generic term is always open to becoming limited to a single meaning. But we have to understand Bible words as they were understood by the ancient peoples who originally read them. It's a fallacy to claim that a word always means what it used to mean, or that it always means what it most often means. That's not necessarily true. So the question becomes then, can we find in the Bible any passage where intoxicating beverages and God's approval are in the same place? And if we can't find that, then this creates a problem for the idea of social drinking. And while we're on that subject, here's another point that I think is very important for us to consider. The word drunken in the Bible does not always mean intoxicated. Now, if you have never come to terms with that information, it may seem shocking and you may doubt it, but I encourage you to check this out. The word drunken in the Bible does not always mean intoxicated. It is a wider word than that. It means to drink to the full. It means to be satiated. Now, if what you were drinking to the point of satiation is inebriating, then the idea of intoxication is implied. But if you were drinking something that was not inebriating, then it only means satiation. There is no moral dilemma in abstaining from alcohol. If you decide you're not going to participate in the drinking of alcohol, you don't have any moral dilemma there. You don't have any question about where to stop or start. You don't have to face any of those issues. The problem is settled for you, and you can live your life that way. Any view that creates a moral dilemma ought to be somewhat suspect and ought to be investigated. I believe that the view that social drinking is approved by the Bible is a view like that. It's suspect, and it ought to be investigated. The negative on this argument doesn't have to prove anything more than that what the affirmative said isn't true, or at least is not conclusive. As I said, I'm not going to take the time to detail the 13 Bible words for wine and the contents in which, the context in which they are used. There's enough conflict among the scholars on some of those words to warrant your own personal investigation of them if you're interested in the subject, and I hope you are interested in this subject if it seems germane to you. But I would like to look with you in our remaining time at a few commonly discussed passages that come up when we discuss the issue of intoxicating alcohol, ethyl alcohol, as the Bible speaks of it. First passage I'd like to talk with you about is in Acts 2 and 13. These men are full of new wine. Now, I don't think I need to paint the context for you. This is the day of Pentecost, and it was said of the apostles when they were speaking in tongues that these men are full of new wines. The Greek word there is glucose. Do we have to conclude from the jibe of the Jews, these men are full of new wine, that glucose was intoxicating? Did Peter acknowledge by his answer that it was possible to be intoxicated by glucose? I don't think so. I think there is more than one way to read this. We don't have the tone of voice. We don't have the expressions on faces. What we have are the words here, and that's apparently sufficient. But remember, the ancient people were just as capable of sarcasm and irony as we are. The ancient people could look at a drunk and say, well, he's had a little too much of the grape. Looks like he's been hitting the grape juice. Yes, they thought the apostles were intoxicated. There's no question about that. But that doesn't prove that glucose was intoxicating. That's my point. The mockers were very possibly using sarcasm. It seems to me that they were, because new wine was not intoxicating. It just came out of the grape, or it was in the same condition as when it just came out of the grape. It's as if they looked at them and called them water drinkers. Somebody might look at a drunk and say, well, he's been at the medicine again. This is a sarcastic kind of a statement to make. And the Bible is full of this type of thing. In the 28th chapter of the book of Ezekiel, when he's talking, it is said to the king or the boss of Tyre there, you are wiser than Daniel. Now, was that literally true? Of course it wasn't. He wasn't even close to being near as wise as Daniel. This was mockery. It was sarcasm to make a point. Oh, you're wiser than Daniel. We have another one in the book of Job, in Job 12, verse 2. When coming back at the people that are antagonistic to him, he says, no doubt, no doubt, you are the people, and knowledge will die with you. Now, that is sarcasm, and the Bible has this all through it. I think it's perfectly possible that that's what the Jews were saying. These men are full of new wine, implying that they were drunk, but not that they would get drunk literally on drinking new wine. It's the same principle as if somebody says something that's very obvious in our present, and we say, oh, that's brilliant, Einstein. What was your first clue on that, Sherlock? Those types of things. These men are full of new wine. Peter's response was based on the custom of that day. They that are drunk in the night, ordinarily. They wouldn't be drunk at 9 o'clock in the morning. Please remember that a thing may be forbidden in a passage without that thing being regarded as evil. The Nazarites couldn't even eat raisins. They couldn't eat grapes. And there's obviously no evil in the grape. It was wrong for the Nazarites to eat them, even though the grapes were not evil, the raisins were not evil in themselves. How do we explain the fact that the word yanin, which is translated wine, is said to be both a blessing and an evil? It's because there is an intrinsic difference between unintoxicating and intoxicating wine. One is the production of the life-giving God. The other is the result of decay and the art of man. One is a blessing and the other is a mocker. And the same words are used to refer to both. Anything that is in excess is denounced. Honey, for example, in Proverbs 25, verse 27. We are told there that it's not good to eat much honey. And if you've eaten a lot of honey at one time, you may have found the truth of that. Honey is great. It's almost pure sugar. In a natural form, it's great, and it's good for you ordinarily. But if you eat too much of it, you know that it can kind of turn your stomach, and it's just too much at once. And so it's denounced. Not that there's anything wrong with honey, but it's just denounced. On the other hand, the alcoholic wine, Proverbs 20, verse 1, is said to be a mocker. Not in excess, but just a mocker. The flat statement is that it is a mocker. Strong drink is raging, and whoso is deceived thereby is not wise. We don't hear anything about excess here. We hear that the thing itself is a mocker. And I believe if that passage read, crystal meth is a mocker, that we wouldn't hear the excess argument on this, because who thinks that people are okay to use some crystal meth as long as they don't use too much of it? We need to think these things through, and during our dinner hour, maybe we'll be able to do some of that together. Lord willing, we'll come back this afternoon at the appointed time and talk about this subject some more, remembering that we ought to be students of the Bible and not just readers of what others say about the Bible or what it means, not just hearers of what others say about the Bible. We ought to study these issues through for ourselves and come to our conclusions about them. So, Lord willing, we'll hopefully consider that this afternoon. We're just getting started on this. We come to the time now, though, to extend the Lord's invitation. And in a moment, we're going to rise and sing number 516, which is a very appropriate song that Kyle has selected for the invitation. I bring my sins to thee, the sins I cannot count. If you're outside of Jesus Christ today, I know that this lesson has not been primarily for you, and I'm sure that you're aware of that as well. But there may be someone here, and never knowing the hearts of those present, we customarily extend the invitation, for whom it is the right time to accept our Lord at His Word, believing that He is the Messiah, the Son of God, and ready to be immersed in water for the remission of your sins based on your faith in Him and your confession of Him. If that is your case, then this invitation is for you. If you would like to place your membership with this congregation, if you have sinned a personal sin that was public enough that it attracted public attention and needs to be publicly acknowledged, this invitation is for you to make that right. In fact, there are many people who can respond to this invitation in an appropriate way. And if that is your case today, we encourage you to come to the front and let us do what we can to try to help you as we stand and sing number 516.